Chapter 37. Beware. The tremulous effort and the broken, inadequate tone of the faint cry, surprised, lingered more than the unexpected suddenness of the warning conveyed. He did not know by whom and to whom. Besides himself, there was no one in the courtyard as far as he could see. The cry was not renewed, and his watchful eyes, scanning warily the misty solitude of Willem's enclosure, were met everywhere only by the stolid impassiveness of inanimate things. The big somber-looking tree, the shut-up, sightless house, the glistening bamboo fences, the damp and drooping bushes further off, all these things, that condemned to look forever at the incomprehensible afflictions or joys of mankind, assert in their aspect of cold unconcern the high dignity of lifeless matter that surrounds, incurious and unmoved, the restless mysteries of the ever-changing, of the never-ending life. Lingered, stepping aside, put the trunk of the tree between himself and the house, then, moving cautiously round one of the projecting buttresses, had to tread short in order to avoid scattering a small heap of black embers upon which he came unexpectedly on the other side. A thin, wizened, little old woman, who, standing behind the tree, had been looking at the house, turned towards him with a start, gazed with faded expressionless eyes at the intruder, then made a limping attempt to get away. She seemed, however, to realize directly the hopelessness or the difficulty of the undertaking, stopped, hesitated, tottered back slowly, then, after blinking dully, fell suddenly on her knees amongst the white ashes, and, bending over the heap of smoldering coals, distended her sunken cheeks in a steady effort to blow up the hidden sparks into a useful blaze. Lingard looked down on her, but she seemed to have made up her mind that there was not enough life left in her lean body for anything else than the discharge of the simple domestic duty, and, apparently, she begrudged him the least moment of attention. After waiting for a while, Lingard asked, "Why did you call, oh daughter?" "I saw you enter," she croaked feebly, still groveling with her face near the ashes, "and without looking up, and I called the cry of warning. It was her order. Her order," she repeated, with a moaning sigh. "And did she hear?" pursued Lingard, with gentle composure. Her projecting shoulder blades moved uneasily under the thin stuff of the tight body jacket. She scrambled up with difficulty to her feet, and hobbled away, muttering peevishly to herself, towards a pile of dry brushwood heaped up against the fence. Lingard, looking idly after her, heard the rattle of loose planks that led from the ground to the door of the house. He moved his head beyond the shelter of the tree, and saw Asa coming down the inclined way into the courtyard. After making a few hurried paces towards the tree, she stopped with one foot advanced in an appearance of sudden terror, and her eyes glanced wildly right and left. Her head was uncovered. A blue cloth wrapped her from her head, 2 foot in close slanting folds, with one end thrown over her shoulder. A tress of her black hair strayed across her bosom. Her bare arms pressed down close to her body, with hands open and outstretched fingers. Her slightly elevated shoulders and the backward inclination of her torso gave her the aspect of one defiant, yet shrinking from a coming blow. As he had closed the door of the house behind her, and as she stood solitary in the unnatural and threatening twilight of the murky day, with everything unchanged around her, she appeared to Lingard, as if as he had been made there, on the spot, out of the black vapors of the sky, and of the sinister gleams of feeble sunshine that struggled, through the thickening clouds, into the colorless desolation of the world. After a short, but attentive glance towards the shut-up house, Lingard stepped out from behind the tree and advanced slowly towards her. The sudden fixity of her till then restless eyes, and a slight twitch of her hands were the only signs she gave at first of having seen him. She made a long stride forward, and putting herself right in his path, stretched her arms across, her black eyes opened wide, her lips parted, as if in an uncertain attempt to speak. But no sound came out to break the significant silence of their meeting. Lingard stopped and looked at her with stern curiosity. After a while he said composedly, "Let me pass. I came here to talk to a man. Does he hide? Has he sent you? She made a step nearer, her arms fell by her side, then she put them straight out, nearly touching Lingard's breast. He knows not fear, she said, speaking low, with a forward throw of her head, in a voice trembling but distinct. He is my own fear that has sent me here. He sleeps. He has slept long enough, said Lingard, in measured tones. Come, and now is the time of his waking. Go and tell him this, or else my own voice will call him up. A voice he knows well. He put her hands down firmly and again made, as if to pass by her. Do not, she exclaimed, and fell at his feet, as if as he had been cut down by a scythe. The unexpected suddenness of her movement startled Lingard, who stepped back. What's this? He exclaimed in a wondering whisper, then added in a tone of sharp command, stand up. She rose at once, and stood looking at him, timorous and fearless, yet with a fire of recklessness burning in her eyes that made clear her resolve to pursue her purpose even to the death. Lingard went on in a severe voice, go out of my path. You are Omer's daughter, and you ought to know that, when men meet in daylight, women must be silent, and abide their fate. Women, she retorted, with subdued vehemence. Yes, I am a woman. Here I see that, O Rajalot, but can you see my life? I also have heard, O man of many fights, I also have heard the voice of firearms. I also have felt the rain of young twigs, and of leaves cut up by bullets fall down about my head. I also know how to look in silence at angry faces, and at strong hands raised high grasping sharp steel. I also saw men fall dead around me without a cry of fear and of mourning. And I have watched the sleep of weary fugitives, and looked at night shadows full of menace and death with eyes that knew nothing but watchfulness. And, she went on, with a mournful drop in her voice, I have faced the heartless sea, held on my lap the heads of those who died raving from thirst, and from their cold hands took the paddle and worked, so that those with me did not know that one man more was dead. I did all this. What more have you done? That was my life. What has been yours? The matter and the manner of her speech held Lingard motionless, attentive and approving against his will. She ceased speaking, and from her staring black eyes with a narrow border of white above and below, a double ray of her very soul streamed out in a fierce desire to light up the most obscure designs of his heart. After a long silence, which served to emphasize the meaning of her words, she added in the whisper of bitter regret, and I have knelt at your feet. And I am afraid. You, said Lingard deliberately, and returning her look with an interested gaze, you are a woman whose heart, I believe, is great enough to fill a man's breast. But still you are a woman, and to you, I, Rajalot, have nothing to say. She listened, bending her head in a movement of forced attention, and his voice sounded to her unexpected, far off, with the distant and unearthly ring of voices that we hear in dreams, saying faintly things startling, cruel or absurd, to which there is no possible reply. To her he had nothing to say. She wrung her hands, glanced over the courtyard with that eager and distracted look that sees nothing, then looked up at the hopeless sky of livid gray and drifting black, at the unquiet morning of the hot and brilliant heaven that had seen the beginning of her love, that had heard his entreaties and her answers, that had seen his desire and her fear, that had seen her joy, her surrender and his defeat. Lingard moved a little, and this slight stir near her precipitated her disordered and shapeless thoughts into hurried words. Wait, she exclaimed in a stifled voice, and went on disconnectedly and rapidly, Tay. I have heard. Men often spoke by the fires. Men of my people. And they said of you the first on the sea, they said that to men's cries you were deaf in battle, but after. No. Even while you fought, your ears were open to the voice of children and women. They said. That. Now I, a woman, I, she broke off suddenly, and stood before him with dropped eyelids and parted lips, so still now that she seemed to have been changed into a breathless, an unhearing, an unseeing figure, without knowledge of fear or hope, of anger or despair. and the astounding repose that came on her face. Nothing moved but the delicate nostrils that expanded and collapsed quickly, flutteringly, in interrupted beats, like the wings of a snared bird. "I am white," said Lingard, proudly, looking at her with a steady gaze, where simple curiosity was giving way to a pitying annoyance, "and men you have heard, spoke only what is true over the evening fires. My ears are open to your prayer. But listen to me before you speak. For yourself you need not be afraid. You can come even now with me, and you shall find refuge in the household of Said Abdullah, who is of your own faith. And this also you must know. Nothing that you may say will change my purpose towards the man who is sleeping or hiding in that house." Again she gave him a look that was like a stab, not of anger but of desire, of the intense, overpowering desire to see in, to see through, to understand everything. Every thought, emotion, purpose, every impulse, every hesitation inside that man, inside that white-clad foreign being who looked at her, who spoke to her, who breathed before her like any other man, but bigger, red-faced, white-haired and mysterious. It was the future clothed in flesh, the tomorrow, the day after, all the days, all the years of her life standing there before her alive and secret, with all their good or evil shut up within the breast of that man who could be persuaded, cajoled, entreated, perhaps touched, worried, frightened, who knows, if only first he could be understood. As he had seen a long time ago whither events were tending, as he had noted the contemptuous yet menacing coldness of Abdullah, as he had heard alarmed, yet unbelieving Babalatchi's gloomy hints, covert allusions and veiled suggestions, to abandon the useless white man whose fate would be the price of the peace secured by the wise and good who had no need of him anymore. And he himself. She clung to him. There was nobody else. Nothing else. She would try to cling to him always all her life. And yet he was far from her. Further every day. Every day he seemed more distant, and she followed him patiently, hopefully, blindly, but steadily, through all the devious wanderings of his mind. She followed as well as she could. Yet at times very often lately as he had felt lost like one strayed in the thickets of tangled undergrowth of a great forest. To her the ex-clerk of old Hudig appeared as remote, as brilliant, as terrible, as necessary, as the sun that gives life to these lands. The sun of unclouded skies that dazzles and withers. The sun beneficent and wicked, the giver of light, perfume, and pestilence. As he had watched him close, fascinated by love, fascinated by danger. He was alone now but for her. And she thought that he was like a man afraid of something. Was it possible? He afraid? Of what? Was it of that old white man who was coming, who had come? Possibly. As he had heard of that man ever since she could remember. The bravest were afraid of him. And now what was in the mind of this old man who looked so strong? What was he going to do with the light of her life? Put it out? Take it away? Take it away forever. Forever. And leave her in darkness. Not in the stirring, whispering, expectant night in which the hushed world awaits the return of sunshine, but in the night without end, the night of the grave, where nothing breathes, nothing moves, nothing thinks, the last darkness of cold and silence without hope of another sunrise. She cried, "Our purpose. You know nothing. I must." Dot, he interrupted unreasonably excited, as he had, by her look, inoculated him with some of her own distress. I know enough. She approached, and stood facing him at arm's length, with both her hands on his shoulders, and he, surprised by that audacity, closed and opened his eyes two or three times, aware of some emotion arising within him, from her words, her tone, her contact. An emotion unknown, singular, penetrating and sad at the close sight of that strange woman, of that being savage and tender, strong and delicate, fearful and resolute, that had got entangled so fatally between their two lives, his own, and that other white man's, the abominable scoundrel. How can you know? She went on, in a persuasive tone that seemed to flow out of her very heart. How can you know? I live with him all the days, all the nights. I look at him. I see his every breath, every glance of his eye, every movement of his lips. I see nothing else. What else is there? And even I do not understand. I do not understand him. Him. My life. Him who to me is so great that his presence hides the earth and the water from my sight. Lingard stood straight, with his hands deep in the pockets of his jacket. His eyes winked quickly, because she spoke very close to his face. She disturbed him, and he had a sense of the efforts he was making to get hold of her meaning, while all the time he could not help telling himself that all this was of no use. She added after a pause, "Here has been a time when I could understand him. When I knew what was in his mind better than he knew it himself. When I felt him. When I held him. And now he has escaped." Escaped? What? Gone away, shouted Lingard. Escaped from me, she said. Left me alone. Alone. And I am ever near him. Yet alone. Her hand slipped slowly off Lingard's shoulders and her arms fell by her side, listless, discouraged, as if to her, the savage, violent, and ignorant creature had been revealed clearly in that moment the tremendous fact of our isolation, of the loneliness impenetrable and transparent, elusive and everlasting, of the indestructible loneliness that surrounds, envelopes, clothes every human soul from the cradle to the grave, and, perhaps, beyond. I. Very well. I understand. His face is turned away from you, said Lingard. Ah, what do you want? I want. I have looked for help. Everywhere. Against men. All men. I do not know. First they came, the invisible whites, and dealt death from afar. Then he came. He came to me who was alone and sad. He came, angry with his brothers, great amongst his own people, angry with those I have not seen, with the people where men have no mercy and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.